are listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Good morning. Welcome to The View and Happy New Year. We are in 2018, aren't we? Oh my goodness. I'm Aisha Hauser and I am right now in Bellevue, Washington. I live in Seattle, but I am at the office today. And we have a really, I'm so excited for this show. We have Jessica York, the co-director of Ministries and Faith Development at the Unitarian Universalist Association. And we have Annie Scott, Lareda Board President and Credentialed Director of Religious Education in Colorado. And we are, and Christina Rivera will be joining us any second as one of the new hosts of The View. So we're waiting for her to come on. And we are going to talk about the Liberal Religious Educators Association Fall Conference. We had, an interesting fall conference. So we do have some live viewers already. Hello and welcome. And I want Annie and Jessica to let us know where you are right now and to say good morning. Go ahead, Annie.
I am in Golden, Colorado at Jefferson Unitarian Church at work. And good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Jessica York. I'm in my home office in a very chilly Birmingham, Alabama this morning and happy to be here.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, me too. So we're going to jump right in as we hope Christina gets on. Sometimes we have folks with technical difficulties, but she will be on any minute. So this past Lareda Fall Conference, Lareda has a fall conference that is fabulous every year. In the fall, this one was the first weekend in September in Denver, Colorado. And the subject or the theme was announced, what would you say, Annie, like late August, early September-ish?
Yeah.
And it was Brave Spaces. We had known it was going to be Brave Spaces, but the speakers were announced, and it was two white men leading about nonviolent communication. My first reaction when I saw it was, at the time, I was more neutral about nonviolent communication, so it's not that I had a knee-jerk reaction that I hated nonviolent communication. It was more, I think in this context of white supremacy and we're talking institutional racism, I don't know that having a conference, I did think by two white men about interpersonal communication was, I personally didn't feel it was maybe quite as useful. So I wrote an email, and Annie, I wrote an email to a few members of the Lareda board, including the fall conference planner. And to all of your credit, I got an email right away. And, I got a call from the fall conference planner right away. And we talked about it. There were some really good reasons why, this was going to go on the way it was. So, okay. So we go to fall conference and, So there's two different issues that I see. And please, Jessica and Annie, jump in at any point, because I'm trying to give a synopsis so we can get into lessons learned. But for me, there were two things going on. One is I already wasn't enthusiastic about the subject matter to begin with. So I already came in a little bit like, with an eye roll, which is on me. But the other piece of it was just the general facilitation skills of the speakers wasn't great. And one of the things that I also kind of kept experiencing is I don't know that these two men realized that we're colleagues. I almost felt like I was spoken to as like almost I was a 10-year-old and needed to be walked through kind of it, rather than, this is our methodology. This is what this is. And we will, I didn't feel that we were being spoken to as colleagues. And so that was my own prejudice. I'm speaking from my point of view. And then when the one white man said, So he said something to the effect of, and each of you, one of you can correct me if I get it wrong, but it's hard being a white man right now at this time or something like that. And then, so he's wanting us to meet, he's wanting to be vulnerable. But then when he kind of kept going with his own personal narrative. And at one point he said, raise your hand if your heart broke open just a little bit towards me. And I folded my hands at that point and I looked around the room, about a third of the people did not raise their hands. And then I was like, and then the whole experience felt to me manipulative. And he led us into exercises that weren't very well explained. So later that night afterwards, so it came and went, and it was what it was. And then one of our colleagues of color, a well-respected professor, black man, said he spoke to them. I said, oh, okay. So a well-respected colleague of color spoke to the two white men individually and said, and gave constructive feedback. Well, the next morning we come in, it did not appear that either of these white men heard that. Then Jessica York, another well-respected colleague of color, gets up during the program and gives again constructive feedback, which again is ignored. Then I was kind of done. At that point, I literally get up and I said, and the person kept saying, oh, that resonates with me, and just giving nonsense again. And then this speaks to the poor facilitation skills. And then I just get up and I was pretty much like, you have to stop talking. So, because at one point he says, I don't know what to say. I said, good, stop talking. And then it was a white woman who got up and said, this program needs to stop. This needs to end. Or I don't know exactly how she put it. And then, you know, a lot of people spoke and some people thought everything was fine. And then others said, this is not going well. But that point, which is where I want you both to come in, was this is what I'd never seen in a UU space before. The entire program was basically a timeout and was shut down because it was not going well. For what I realized later is for different reasons for many people. I wasn't personally hurt. I was frustrated. I started to become angry when I saw a second well-respected colleague of color be basically dissed. And then I just really, and so I had a, so that's my synopsis. So Annie, Jessica, jump in with, if you want to add more to the synopsis or take it from kind of what we started happening once the entire program was, I don't know if the word is shut down, but redirected, trying to find gentle words here. So Annie, you want to jump in?
Well, I definitely think it was shut down. I mean, I would use that strong language. So let me just speak personally for a second. You know, partly inspired by some of the lessons. So in September, I fell on the first day of the church year and had a concussion. And it was mild, but it definitely had an impact. And so part of my experience at Fall Conference was that my brain was impacted. And so after Friday night, I didn't sleep, basically. So Saturday morning, I get up and I do some kind of welcome or something. Can't even remember now. And I went up to my room to try to get some sleep and couldn't sleep. So I was doing a meditation and all of a sudden my phone starts going, wah, wah. And I get a call from a board member who said, you got to get down here. Things are blowing up or something, very dramatic language. And I came down and, you know, had a couple of board members in my ear and basically saying, we need to shut this down. They kind of talked me all the way into the room. And I went up on the stage and said, okay, we're shutting this down. I'm not sure what we're going to do, but something. And you know, I share the concussion piece because it really demanded of me that I be in collaboration, that I be in community, that I set aside the sort of the white cultural inclination that I've got to do this on my own, I've got to respond, I've got to, and so it really became very much we. And I mean, it was clear to me by Friday night, the speakers, that for myself as a white, 65-year-old, that the patriarchy of the patronizing attitude of the presenters, was setting stuff off in me. I had my own personal reaction to it. So. I got on a kind of a gut level what the problem was. And so it was an interesting experience. We shut it down and basically people of color were off to caucus. And so fortunately we had a person come up with an idea for what the white people could be doing. Hey, Christina.
Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Keep going.
So the white people had a conversation. I don't know what they did. I was off. So the board and the Lareda Diversity and Integrity team met and basically put out an invitation to people of color, an invitation to come and talk to us when they were interested and ready to do that. And so my experience, yeah.
Before you go on, I wanted Jessica to go up to this point too. If we can kind of have parallel. Yes. And then Christina, we gave a synopsis of Volcan and now we're up to kind of impressions just until the disruption and then we'll go into lesson learned. So Jessica.
Yes. So, you know, to give a little pre-conference synopsis, to weigh in as Aisha did, I too was not enthusiastic about the topic. I'd heard a little about nonviolent communication before this. I certainly know that it has quite a bit of popularity in many of our Unitarian Universalist settings. But I did a little digging around and discovered that there were, you know, a number of articles on the internet about nonviolent communication and some of the issues with it. When you're dealing with people with marginalized identities. And, you know, I just didn't see it as a brave topic, whether or not it was an appropriate topic. It didn't seem to fit the theme. And as you mentioned, Aisha, you know, we found out very late. I know the board, as a matter of fact, also found out very late exactly who the presenters were for the conference. I was going to go, of course, because I always go to Lareda Fall Conference. That's, you know, that's where my people are. And I love being there. And it is a great time for us to be together every year. But I wasn't particularly interested in the programming and thought, oh, maybe I can do some work during that part of the programming. Yes, I admit, that's what I was thinking. But as I started to look at it and read the articles on the web, and as I talked to other members in the Faith Development Office, I began to get an inkling that maybe this program was going to be problematic, the presentation for it. And so I better be present for that. There is a slide that is called, I think, Critiques of White Supremacy. And if we could have that slide posted for folks to see, that might be helpful. The slide was put together by Dr. Mark Hicks. Many of you know that Mark Hicks is the Angus MacLean Professor of Religious Education at Meville Lombard and is the director of the FOS Collaborative Laboratory for Innovation and Faith Formation. The slide is useful. It's created from a document by Kenneth Jones and Tim Akun. So this shows some of the aspects of white supremacy culture. It's not comprehensive. It doesn't show them all, but it shows some of the ones that, you know, have a real tendency to creep into our culture. And I wanted to show this because so much of what happened during the presentation from the two presenters just reflected many of these aspects. We've already heard both of you guys talk about the paternalism that was there. And I know that paternalism was bothering many of the women who were in the room and maybe even some of the men who were in the room too, and people of other genders. Even, you know, aside from the issues with the people of color and some of the critiques they may have had of the presentation, there was the fear of open conflict because every time real objections were raised with the presenters, they gave these kind of rote answers back that they obviously had practiced well from their coaching in nonviolent communication. The individualism, the right to comfort. As Aisha mentioned, one of the presenters talked about how difficult it was for him as a white male to be there and kept making choices that really seemed to prioritize his comfort over the needs of other people in the room. The perfectionism, And so much of that was just evident in their presentation. You know, there were places where a lot of power hoarding was happening. And, you know, that was something that I maybe hadn't given a lot of thought to before this conference, but certainly, you know, to witness it, and it was subtle in some ways, right? The presenter would present us with choices, but they weren't real choices. They were choices that appeared to make it so that we were co-creating this experience together. But that really wasn't the reality. One example of that that I can give to folks is that they gave us some instructions. They said, sometimes it's hard when you're in a large group and you go into small groups. It's hard to leave your small group and come back to the larger group. But for the sake of time and for this process, we need you to be able to do that. So we're going to meet in the large group, and then you're going to go in your small group for so many minutes. And then we're going to ask you to come back to the larger group. Now, raise your hand if you think that you won't be able to follow those instructions. Who's going to raise their hand to that? But they kept giving false choices like that. Aside from that, you know, Aisha, I believe, touched on this. A lot of the process just was not good in terms of what they were trying to lead us through educationally. They did very little processing of activities. We would go through an activity. They'd ask for some feedback. They praised the feedback that was in line with what they wanted us to feel. They basically ignored the feedback that was critical. And then we were left to process things by ourselves. There was a forced intimacy on the very first night of the program, which was problematic for some people who had previously experienced abuse.
Can I just jump in that on the forced intimacy thing that, you know, I mean, I'm an extrovert. So, you know, I'm out there talking to people and such. But one of the experiences that I had Friday night was we were asked to go up to strangers and stare at them, you know, look in their eyes for whatever long. And I didn't want to do that. I was tired. I didn't want to do that. It was Friday night. You know, it's like a room of 200 and whatever people. And the option was, if you wanted to opt out, you were to sit at a table and face the center of the table with your back to the room. Well, that to me was not an option. That felt rude. And so it didn't feel like an option to me not to do it. So I did it and didn't like it. Okay, sorry.
Exactly.
Just wanted to share that example.
You know, there were a lot of people who were very uncomfortable with that first night's presentation. We had many newcomers at fall conference who were suddenly in a room with 200 individuals, and they may not have known any of those individuals in that room. And now they were to go up to them. They were to, yes, stare in their eyes for several minutes. They were to hold their hand and close their eyes with those individuals. And once our eyes were closed, they asked us the question, can you tell the race of the person whose hand you're holding? And I think that was their nod to trying to, you know, dismantle white supremacy in their presentation. And a number of the newcomers expressed to me how uncomfortable they were with this activity. I know of some people who left the room during this activity. And again, there was no processing of it that happened afterwards. I think that kind of brings me up to where we are when we basically stop the process. And, you know, I agree with Aisha that I don't think there's very many spaces, Unitarian Universalist spaces or other conference spaces, period, where the organizers would really have the courage to just stop and say, we're going to regroup and we're going to rethink this.
I'm wondering, Annie or Jessica, if either of you can speak to, and if this might have been touched on a little bit, of when it was getting really tense on Saturday morning, and there was this back and forth that was happening between folks in the audience in the room and the facilitator. And at one point somebody said kind of clearly, there are two different experiences going on here in this room and what that felt like to each of you at that moment. Because I remember sitting where I was sitting at, and it that was such a clear articulation of what was happening, because I felt like there were people in the room who were like, yes, this is great stuff. This is what I need. This is a tool that I'm going to be able to use. this is breaking open things for me that I hadn't thought about before. And yet at the same time, in that same space, sitting right next to each other, some other folks were having a very different experience. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you experienced that, or what that might have felt like.
I was the one who said that, just to say. That was exactly the first thing. So I was noticing, that was the first thing that I said, is there are different experiences happening in this room. And because I was seeing it, I was noticing what was happening with me and the folks around me, and then other people who are gladly going along. And so thank you for that.
Well, so Christina, you missed my confession that I wasn't even in the room. So it's clear to me that when Aisha said it, that the board was hearing it. And clearly other board members didn't feel like they could get up and stop what was going on, but wanted to. I mean, that's about all I can say. Mm-hmm. I certainly have heard from lots of people who experienced that different sense, difference in experience. Yeah. Jessica? Mm-hmm.
I think you are, you know, absolutely correct, Christina, in terms of lifting that up as, I think that's an important learning to take away from the conference. So I don't want to push us into the learning piece. But, you know, one of the questions I'm left with after the conference is, how do we do this work together, knowing that we bring such different life experiences and identities and expectations to the work that we're doing? I know a number of people who were enjoying the presentation, who were really getting something out of it, and who think that this could be a really useful tool for them in the future. And that's absolutely true for them, right? That's their truth. And I understand that they were very frustrated when the program was stopped, that there were people who were thinking that this was unprofessional to stop the program. They felt like they had come to a professional conference, they were going to get tools to take back, and they were basically denied those tools when the program was stopped. And I imagine there's probably some people out there who think that the program was perhaps stopped and then changed for what they may see as a small minority of people who objected to it, which is why once we came with the renewed program and there was an opportunity for other people to voice how they felt about it, it was helpful for me to hear from white women about how they were reacting to the paternalism in the program. And so some of them were happy the program was stopped for that reason. And to hear from people who had been abused previously in their life and to hear how they were reacting to the program, and they were happy it was stopped because of that. So one of the messages that I hope is very clear from this conference, because I know there's conflicting stories out in the UU world about it, is that this conference wasn't just stopped by people of color in the room or for people of color in the room, that there were a number of people from many different walks of life and experiences who were reacting to what may be patterns of white supremacy, but that they weren't just affecting people of color, they were also affecting white people.
And I think that's one of the things that that we forget, right? That white supremacy doesn't just affect people of color, it affects white people as well. The way it affects us, the way we move through white supremacy is very different, but it affects us all, that we are all moving through it. And that I think that to me, that was so important, is that dual experience wasn't just people of color and white people. Mm-hmm. Like there were multiple layers of dual experience that were in the room. And how do we intentionally build lifetime feedback when we're working? We do, and what's fascinating to me is we do this somewhat adeptly as religious educators, right? Like when we're in a classroom and we see that, you know, some kids just aren't connecting with an activity, a lot of times we have tools that are at hand to be able to redirect how the program is being experienced by all the children in the class, or adults in the class for that matter, in adult religious ed. And so, you know, trying to pull those tools into our professional spaces.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, we know how to do those things, and yet even knowing, we still sometimes have trouble making that happen for ourselves.
Yeah, I
think that's important too, Christina, to recognize one thing that I didn't explicitly say is that there were people of color even within the room who were enjoying the experience and were getting something good out of it, right? So, you know, we're no more a monogamous group than any other group of people. And so you have to always be, yes, you know, cognizant of the fact that you've got all these different experiences and these different needs that you're trying to meet in a room of 200 people.
And I think now's a good time to go into the lessons learned, because one of the things that was so inspiring is that Loretta, I mean, Gail Forsythe-Vail kept saying it, we know how to do this. We know how to regroup, right? That is what we do. We're community organizers of our church, for lack of a better, you know, description. And so we did. We went into another room. Folks of color went into one room, the Loretta board, then the Loretta board and bought us lunch and invited us into a room where, and it was what, about 25 people almost? And actually all four of us were in that room processing what happened and how to move forward. And then there was folks from UUMA, there was Paul Langston Daly from the UUSC, the service committee, and we really thought about how do we take this experience and learn,
right?
And restorative justice. And we did, I think we also went through our own, it wasn't a formal restorative justice, but it felt that way to me. Mm-hmm. And so what I just so appreciated, Annie, and it was really very much thanks to your leadership that you listened and you said, okay, what do we do now? And it was just a deeply collaborative space. And we had the whiteboard. And so we can start going into the lessons learned and how we basically replanned fall conference in 2 hours.
Yeah.
So yeah. Go ahead, Annie.
Well, I just want to say for me, I mean, I've done a fair amount of anti-racism training through the years. And part of how I talk about Loretta Fall Conference is that, at least for white people, I think it was the most extraordinary opportunity for learning about the white supremacist culture, not to mention patriarchy, that I have ever had, that I will ever hope to have, because it was in the moment and was with a group of people who were willing to be in the moment together. And so when a portion of the People of Color Caucus came into the room with the Loretta board and the diversity and inclusion team, the first thing that happened was people talked about what their experience so far had been like, how they felt hurt, angry, resentful, betrayed. And one of the most extraordinary experiences for me personally was, so there was some sharing by people of color. I responded as Loretta president, apologizing, owning, you know, saying we're accountable, I'm accountable, and that I'm sorry. And a brave young religious educator of color said, I don't believe you. I think you planned that response. And I felt so honored at that moment to have that level of honesty in the room with people I love and respect and some people I'd never even met before. But to have somebody say that honestly, yeah, I'm here in this moment and, you know, I don't believe you. And then I had another opportunity to say, okay, well, let me tell you more. And like you were saying, then there was a shift to, well, what the hell are we going to do now? And, you know, it's what a group of religious educators can do. And I think then we spent about 2 hours meticulously, completely, you know, saying what parts are we going to keep and what, how are we going to make this a teachable moment? How are we going to take this and make it a worthy experience for everybody there, right? Kind of going back to what you all have talked about, that there were all these experiences in the room. And, you know, part of what I heard about in between everything, you know, goes to the some of the things that Jessica were on your chart that you shared. That sense of white people being uncomfortable, that we think we're owed comfort, and that we were really asking white people especially to sit in your discomfort. We're going to see in a little bit a slide that Christina shared with us, and the notion of embracing discomfort. And that's part of what the whole thing was about, was how uncomfortable can we be and still remain open and vulnerable and ready to learn.
Yeah, I think that's really key to what happened. And to calling it Brave Space. Kathy Siegel is in the chat, and she said, I hope it's appropriate to share that I was extremely grateful and relieved that the original goal of learning to create Brave Space was actually modeled.
Wow, yeah.
And that, to me, you know, it's easy to name a conference, you know, about being Brave Space, but it doesn't feel, you know, I preach this all the time, getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. It's not a comfortable place to be. And if you're uncomfortable, you know you're doing it right. Like if you're comfortable, you're not doing the work. It's just, it's, you know, if it was comfortable, if it was easy, it would already be done. It's going to take us being uncomfortable, being at a level of unease, even POC, you know, I include myself in that, to be able to move this forward. You know, we're not going to be able to just, you know, go to our conferences and go to General Assembly and just have that expectation of, you know, having just a great, comfortable, not being challenged time. That's not the time that I think we're in. And I think that gets back to that brave space that we had that thought of, you know, how do we get there? But then how do we get there and hold that uncomfortable space long enough to actually shift?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm glad you lifted up, Christina, that's, you know, doing this work, it's going to put most of us in uncomfortable spaces, not just the white folks. I mean, we, you know, we talk about them being willing to sit in that discomfort. And sometimes we say that as if we think that, you know, calling out white supremacy when we see it and challenging white supremacy is a comfortable position for people of color to be in. Well, I gotta tell you, for me personally, it's not. It's often a struggle. I am an introvert. And in order to be what society considers successful in this world or in this nation, at least, I feel like in many ways I've had to learn to be whiter than white people. Therefore, challenging white supremacy is both personal. It's about how in my own life I can identify ways that I'm complicit in white supremacy and how I can stop that behavior, and much less calling it out when I see that behavior in other people or in institutions, particularly institutions that I'm a part of and institutions that have many aspects that I love and really care about. So to me, one of the big lessons about this was about how do we go about calling out white supremacy? And when we're calling it out, honoring the experiences of everybody who's there in the room, and honoring the fact that everybody is sitting in some discomfort in terms of doing this.
Yeah, it was emotional. There was a lot of emotions for me during the weekend. And one of the gifts was that you both agreed to lead a white supremacy teach-in because it occurred to me as we were talking that the slide that you put up, Jessica, was how we got here. I mean, that was one of the things I appreciated, Annie, in your honesty, is just, you know, we had already paid the speakers, you know, we had already, everything was already in place. So it couldn't be, there wasn't a feeling of being able to change before fall conference. And so when the idea of the teaching came up, you know, you both were so gracious and said yes. And really what was fabulous for me is watching, and I wish I had thought, I kicked myself. I said, I should have just taken my phone and taped you both, because or record, you model that teach-ins can be real time, can be, oh, okay, this is what happened, and this is how we were replicating white supremacy culture. And it was really clear. And I think what some of the feedback I got was, and even I saw myself, was like, oh, okay, this can be a teach-in. Teach-ins don't have to be that you get big name speakers or you read a ton of books. It's about, oh, okay, what in our behavior that led to something that wasn't productive or helpful, and listening to each other and feedback. This is what a white supremacy, this is one way a white supremacy teach-in can happen is, oh, this is what we were doing that replicated dominant culture, and this is how we did it different. And you both did an amazing job. And part of what was great about you both doing it is that you start before the programming started on Friday, you both had an honest conversation with each other about where your identities. And so it was kind of a really beautiful bookend. We accidentally did something beautiful and perfect that you both did the teach-in on Sunday, which I really, along with the restorative justice circles, I think that was another part of the brave space is, and that's when my learning was I hadn't realized how many survivors of domestic violence were triggered. And we're talking white people, white women were deeply triggered. And they were in pain. Like I said, my feelings were frustration and anger, not necessarily, I was frustrated, but that was something I didn't see. And then I realized, like, wow, I could see how that would be just deeply, deeply troubling if you are a survivor of domestic abuse, that kind of paternalism. So I want to lift up that you both were so just brilliant in the teaching and modeling that we could do this and learn. And it was such a deep space of learning that I just, and Christina did the, why can't I think of the word?
Summary it's not wrap up.
The summary speaker. You summarized the entire program, which was brilliant.
Could we have that second slide up, the centering slide, which is a slide that Christina actually created, and which she used during the summary that she gave at the end of fall conference. And it's a slide that I've been sharing with people because it really has some of antidotes to white supremacy. And I think the slide is really useful because when we came together in that process that Annie was speaking of, I saw so much of what was happening, reflected in this slide. You talked about we, Annie, you talked about this was something that we did. And, you know, even the teach-in that happened on Sunday morning, Annie and I may have been the two people up on stage, but we were bringing the words of a whole bunch of people with us, not just the people who were in the room who were planning their revised programming, but then Saturday night, several of us were sitting around and giving suggestions. It was important for me to feel as if my words weren't just my words, but we're including the experiences of other people also. So it really was a collaborative experience all the way around. And I think part of what I hope people got from that experience too is the beauty of working in collaboration and the way people bring so many different gifts. Because as I'm sitting here thinking about that, I'm remembering, Christina, that you were up at the dry erase board and you were in that schedule. You were intense with that schedule. You were like, we are going to get this pinned down. We're going to know exactly what we're doing when. There were other people in the room who were, you know, more maybe the idea people who were kind of, you know, up here. Maybe they didn't want to deal with the minutiae of the schedule and pinning all that stuff down. Some people actually left at that point, right? They're like, we can let other people do this piece. But it was because of the various gifts that people were bringing that I think we were able to come up with that revised program, including, having Melissa Carvel-Zimmer there and the contributions that she made. And you mentioned Paul Langston Daly, who also was invited in to do a restorative justice process. It meant a lot to me to know that our colleagues there in ordained ministry were there for us and really wanted this to be as successful a conference as it could be with the revised programming. And we're willing to bring their gifts and skills to that work too.
Melissa Carvel-Zimmer, the minister who is the executive director of the UUMA, was sitting next to me and we were both kind of saying to each other, processing everything that was happening Saturday morning. I finally got up. And then, you know, she turned to me and she said, do you think it's okay if I get up? I'm like, yes. And so, you know, she got, you know, so it was a lot of support and she was supportive every step of the way. And her, there were, yes, it was really, inspiring. Yeah. Annie, Christina.
Yeah. I guess I want to say something about, you know, the whole experience that Jessica and I had of going up Sunday morning and talking. I want to say something about, you know, both my relationships with you, Aisha, and you, Jessica, that, you know, you and I have known each other a long time. This wasn't two strangers getting up and bearing their souls to each other. That, you know, both of you shared with me before the conference concerns you had about the speakers. And that's what birthed the Friday night conversation that Jessica and I had. So it's the importance of long-term relationships. And, you know, what an extraordinary experience to have both of you have talked to me beforehand, had given me the opportunity that perhaps I could have, should have done something beforehand differently, and didn't occur to me, like you were saying, Aisha. And that there we were in conversation, in relationship with each other, calling each other out, apologizing, being accountable, and continuing to love and respect and hold each other in care.
Because of technical difficulties, this podcast episode of The View ends here. But please tune in next week, where our hosts will be continuing the discussion with multicultural centering. If you would like to learn more about the CLF or hear other episodes of The View, visit questformeaning.org.